I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's been an eventful couple of years in politics, but does that make ordinary citizens more or less interested in government? In the upcoming November elections, what specific issues will drive Missourians to the polls? Today we join with Beyond the Ballot, a new statewide series, to determine the motivations and desires of voters in the Show Me State. Then, baseball has a long history here, but the stories of Mexican immigrants in Kansas playing in the early days of the 20th century have been missing. We'll learn about the role the sport played in confronting discrimination and promoting social equality. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What's truly motivating Missouri voters this year? Missouri Public Radio Station set out on a quest to answer that question with a series of stories that were intended to go beyond the horse race aspect of this year's race. In other words, we wanted to do more than merely ask who's ahead. Now we'll bring you conversations with three reporters who provided pieces for this series. One will deal with voters of faith down in the Ozarks, another with the voters in moderate Clay County just north of here, and that county routinely swings between Democratic and Republican candidates. But first, let's head down to the Ozarks. We'll take a look at how people of faith are approaching this midterm election there. And for that, let's bring in reporter Jennifer Moore from member station KSMU. Jennifer, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, why did you decide to focus on people of faith, Jennifer?
Well, here in southwest Missouri and the wider Ozarks region, which is what our public radio station covers, it's known as one of the most highly concentrated areas in the country for evangelical Christians. And so we really wanted to bring in that voice and really get to the nuts and bolts of what is driving them in terms of faith, a faith community going into the November ballot box.
Where did you decide to go to get this story?
Oh, that's a great question. So reporters reach out to different groups, to different faith groups, different political groups. For this particular story, I reached out to an organization called the Council of Churches of the Ozarks, and it's a pretty remarkable organization down here of scores of mostly churches, some other faith groups as well, that partner up to provide social services here in mostly Springfield. They shelter homeless women. They provide food and hygiene for those in need, and many, many other services. And I told them what we're looking for, and we wanted to find out how faith impacts the vote in terms of different faith communities. So that got us rolling.
You know, I was struck by one comment in your piece, Jennifer, from Executive Director Mark Struckoff, who heads that group you just mentioned, the Council of Churches of the Ozarks. He mentioned that all these services that the council provides, you mentioned some of them, providing shelter to homeless women, responding to natural disasters, feeding food to the hungry. He told you that the need is up in almost all of these different categories, despite how well the economy is doing. What did you make of that?
Well, we do live in a high poverty area. In fact, the congressional districts that we serve are continually ranked among some of the poorest in the country, particularly the more rural congressional districts that we serve here in our listening area. And so I wasn't surprised by that. But, you know, we really, in our story, wanted to look at how different voters can basically look at the same problems in a community and even at the same scripture and interpret that differently. And really was a fascinating insight, I think, into how that interpretation can lead different people to take a different angle on politics and on the vote.
I was struck, too, by how often the voters you talk to refer to their faith when discussing how they'll vote. How common was that?
Well, again, we were looking specifically at religion, so we wanted to hear how faith impacts votes, regardless of how people vote. And so, I think that's going to vary from place to place. But again, here in the Ozarks region, it is considered a very, compared to the rest of the country, I would say, a very religious community, a very religious part of the country. And according to a project that was a part of a PBS NewsHour project called the Patchwork Nation, this area was identified as an evangelical epicenter that was one of the most highly concentrated places in the country, again, for evangelical Christians who have largely sided with President Trump. And so we wanted to see how that is going to affect the Missouri vote as well.
I'm visiting with Jennifer Moore. She's news director of KSMU, about the impact of faith on how people are voting down in the Ozarks this year. You began your piece by talking with a member of Missouri Faith Voices. Tell us about that group.
Yeah, Missouri Faith Voices is a non-denominational faith group. They have branches or chapters, rather, in several cities, including Jefferson City and Springfield, St. Louis, and perhaps others as well. And they really try to work in different issues of fighting poverty and race inequality, and really are tied to churches as well. And so traditionally, a lot of their positions will align more with the Democratic Party issues, but they are not affiliated with the Democratic Party. It's just kind of how the chips fall when it comes to their projects. But they are very active here. It's a small group, I would say, relative to the larger population, but they are very vocal. They hold press conferences. They have volunteer phone bank drives, and they're gearing up for the issues important to them in November.
Given the fact they tend to support Democratic issues, Jennifer, in a part of the state that is so staunchly Republican, how does that go over? How well are they received?
You know, I think they have kind of carved their own name into the tree, so to speak, down here, and people are familiar with what they are fighting for. And I will say, though, that there is some overlap between Faith Voices, this group, and other more conservative faith groups. One of the issues that they have all come together to advocate against is so-called payday loans or predatory lenders. There is a real camaraderie among churches here that needs some serious reform across the state of Missouri.
On the day you visited, again, you mentioned they are pushing for Prop B, which would boost the minimum wage. What are they doing to advocate for that cause?
The night that I was there reporting on this group, they had several volunteers, and they had convened in a local church, and they were calling voters across the state, not just in Springfield, to advocate for the passage of Proposition B, which, as you mentioned, would gradually raise Missouri's minimum wage over the course of several years. And their approach to this, as a matter of faith, was to say, look, we are commissioned by our faith to care for the weak and vulnerable, to care for the poor. And it is very difficult, they hold, to have a family or even in some individuals be able to thrive on the current minimum wage. And so they were gathering to make phone calls and say, hey, this is important. Will you please support this come November?
You know, just briefly, as I know you have to go, Jennifer, any trends you came across among people of faith that was notable?
You know, what I thought was fascinating was in talking to the evangelical folks down here, which I would say are much higher in number in population than the more liberal voters, would be that they are sticking to their same convictions that they had going into 2016 in that contentious election, and very much still in support of President Donald Trump, and seeing Josh Hawley as a beacon of hope for them in the U.S. Senate.
That's Jennifer Moore. She's news director from member station KSMU. Jennifer, thanks so much for your help today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, now let's take a look at young voters in Missouri and what's motivating them these days, if they're motivated at all. Is the student-led anti-gun activism that dominated headlines earlier this year after the shootings in Parkland, Florida, translating into a deeper interest in politics among high schoolers? Joining us now is a former KCUR intern, Aviva Okeson-Haberman of KBIA over in Columbia, who covered this story. Aviva, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, one big question you looked at is how motivated young voters are these days, and is the deeply felt motivation that stirred young people after the Parkland shootings still resonating out there? What did you find out?
Yeah, I think I went into this story expecting to see a large number of high school students who were really fired up about the November election. And there are some high schoolers who are. You know, I talked to a high schooler who was out canvassing, and I talked to a high schooler who was, you know, paying really close attention to what's happening on the national stage. But by and large, I saw that students just weren't that keyed into the November election. You know, some didn't really know who was running in the Senate race. And that surprised me. And I think the reason was because a lot of students just didn't see the relevancy in their life.
Well, where did you go to talk to students?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I talked to students at Jefferson City High School, Boonville, and Bunston. I actually went to classes and I spoke to about, you know, classes of 20 to 25 students. And then I went to four other schools and I just spoke to the teachers there.
You began your piece by talking to St. Dominic High School senior Emma Story over in St. Charles, which is near St. Louis. She was very engaged.
Yeah.
Tell us about her and how you began your piece.
Yeah, so Emma's story was knocking doors. It was a Friday night. She had like golf course tournaments and a lot of homework. And Friday nights, I'm usually in bed. But she was out knocking doors for the GOP. And canvassing is kind of hard because you're directly talking to voters, and that can have a huge impact. But it also means that you're out there yourself. You're not sitting in an office calling people. You know, you may have people say, yeah, I'm not really interested. She felt like this was something that was really important for her. And for her, she was actually engaged even before this race. She tied her interest in politics to President Trump, and she felt like he really energized her. And so he was a really motivating force for her. But she's also keyed into the U.S. Senate race and some other issues that are, you know, happening in the November election.
So you have Emma Story on the one hand, but then you talk to high school teachers about the level of activism among their students, even among their students who are eligible to vote this year. Mm-hmm. And what did they tell you?
Yeah, it was funny. I spoke to a teacher in New Franklin, Adam Quest. He's a history teacher. And so he would know, you know, if students are interested. And he was like, yeah, I'm not even sure if students know that there's a race coming up. That really surprised me. And I think it's, you know, I went into this with an assumption, especially because, you know, if you're a reporter, you're following this really closely, that means everyone is. And that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I imagine on the one hand, at least, it's hard to blame students. They have a whole lot on their plates as they try to navigate their way through the world. What did they say about the fact they're really not that tuned in?
They gave different responses. You know, a lot of them were kind of shy to admit that they weren't paying that much attention.
I was going to say, sure.
Yeah. I think one of the teachers I spoke to actually kind of summed it up best, because he noted that In April, there was this school levy in North Callaway High School. And he saw students were really engaged in that because he saw that they understood how that levy, which would fund schools, directly affected students. And so he actually saw more interest in this race than in the November election. And he just tied it to, you know, students maybe not understanding the relevancy in their life.
You know, Senator Claire McCaskill herself is in your piece. She isn't seeing the engagement among young people that she's used to seeing. What did she tell you?
Yeah, it was funny. She was at the University of Missouri speaking to a room full of college students. And she said, you know, your demographic is not as invested in my campaign. And what she cited was she said there is a fair number of young folks who are volunteering. But if you actually compare that number to the total number of volunteers, it's a very small percentage. And so she just said they weren't as invested. And I asked her afterward, you know, why does she think that's the case? And she said, you know, she wished they would tell me. But again, one theory she mentioned was she just didn't see if they understood the relevancy.
You know, you wonder if they ultimately realize how much potential clout they have, or to what extent, you know, the system has turned away from them to focus on the needs of senior citizens who do vote. I mean, there's such a huge disparity. We spend so much on Social Security and Medicare, which tends to go to older folks, and, you know, support for higher education. That doesn't, you know, wind up as being all that significant. And I'm not sure students really connect those dots that well.
Yeah, two teachers I spoke to when I was in their classes, they kind of went on this rant about that. They said, you know, if you want politicians to pay attention to the issues that matter to you, you need a vote. And they were, you know, two teachers in two different areas, and they gave a very similar talk. It was really interesting.
You wonder ultimately what it would take to really engage young people to vote in a midterm election. After all, I mean, it's a midterm, and it always lacks the zip of a presidential campaign, right?
Exactly. A lot of the people I spoke to said, you know, if this was a presidential election, maybe we'd be seeing something different. And another thing I think that's interesting to note is a lot of the high schoolers I spoke to, when they thought about politics, that's what they thought about. The first word that came to their mind when they thought of the word politics was President Trump. And so their interests, they were engaged to some extent in the national level, but that maybe just did not translate to you know, a Senate race.
Well, here's a fun fact for you. In 2014, which was our last midterm election, only 16% of eligible voters between 18 and 29 actually turned out to vote. I mean, that just hurts to hear a number like that.
Yeah. And we looked at voting records in Cole County, and we found something similar. Just, you know, 17% of 18-year-olds turned out to vote in the last election.
You know, Aviva, I'll just wrap up with this. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, wrote about the level of engagement of young people in a column on Sunday in the Kansas City Star. And he said this: in my 35 years of teaching college students, I've not encountered a generation as dedicated to making the nation better as this one. So I'm counting on them to vote, he said, on November 6th. Sounds like he hasn't spent a lot of time in Missouri here, Aviva.
Yeah, you know, again, it depends on who you talk to. And there certainly are engaged high schoolers who really, really care. But I think just the average high schooler just is not that tuned in.
Well, that certainly is an issue there. That's KCUR's former intern, Aviva Okeson-Haberman of KBIA over in Columbia. Thanks so much for your time. So good to visit with you again.
Thanks for having me.
Finally, let's turn closer to home here and take a look at Clay County, one of those rare jurisdictions that swings back and forth between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to picking statewide candidates. KCUR Samuel King spent some time north of the river there. And Samuel, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on this morning.
You know, there aren't a lot of counties that swing back and forth between the two major parties like Clay County does. What is its recent history when it comes to picking between Democrats and Republicans up there?
Well, I guess you're just talking about the presidential election. In 2016, between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and Donald Trump, of course, winning the state overwhelmingly 19 points. But in Clay County, it was much closer, just closer to 11 points. And there were, of course, other races on that ballot, the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. And in the Senate race, people narrowly chose Kander over Senator Roy Blunt, who eventually won. But at the same time, they voted for Eric Greitens in that race. So even in those three big races there, you saw sort of a big variance in terms of that flipping, as you might were. And also, more recently, this year, we had sort of that special election for the state Senate seat. And Lauren Arthur, who was a state representative,
won
that seat over Kevin Corlew. And Republicans had held that seat for quite a bit of time. So there is just one. And then there's another example someone reminded me of this weekend. I was up in Liberty. It's the District 17. That seat had been held by Republicans for many years. It flipped in 2016 to a Democrat who had won before. And now that race is a bit of a rematch there, going to be in November. So again, just another example of how tight things are when it comes to the parties and why both parties see it as an opportunity.
You know, Samuel, I was surprised when it comes to Clay County population, just by how much it's grown over the years. The numbers you had in your piece just really threw me a little bit. They're big increases.
Yeah, just between 22,000, about 184,000 people, so fewer than 200,000 people. Now the estimate is at 242 as of last year. Could be more people moving up there. There's all kinds of new construction, especially when you get towards sort of 35 and some of the highways there that, you know, people are commuting. So, you know, it is sort of, you have this sort of thing where it's competitive and parties are looking at it because of the voting history, but also the clear fact that people are moving there and it is a bigger pool of voters out there, particularly for statewide candidates.
You know, I was really struck too. We've established here that the county swings back and forth between D's and R's, but there's a sense that things may be changing a little bit in terms of party allegiances. You mentioned the Lauren Arthur race for the state Senate, a Democrat winning the seat. Do you see any kind of shift happening up there?
Well, I think it's one of those things where I think voters, you know, I think there's a shift in terms of the actual numbers. Like we see a sort of the actual races, and we saw the Lauren Arthur race. There are some factors to that. That was literally the first sort of election after the governor resigned. So there could be something. There could be some sort
the
of backlash there.
Right.
Backwash, so we'll see what happens with that. But I do think voters are taking a step back and really looking at the situation and looking at sort of what are we going after. So it'll be interesting to see in the fall whether that continues to hold, where we're actually going to see one party tend to continue a momentum, or we're going to kind of see things where they were.
Where did you go up in Clay County, Samuel, to do your reporting up there?
Went to a couple of places. It started in North Kansas City, just on Armour Road there, which is sort of the shopping road there, and speaking with people. Also stopped in a park. There were a couple of people who were there kind of showing you how, you know, how the county is. There are a couple of people there who actually didn't live in the county, so we didn't use them in the piece.
Yeah.
But it would be instructive for sort of some of the statewide things that, you know, people are paying attention to some of these races. Also went to the square in downtown Liberty and talked to people there. And it was striking just how you talk to one person, they see this way. You talk to another person, just steps away. They speak, you know, they thought another way. So
wow.
It was a really interesting sort of cross-section of what people are thinking and what voters are thinking.
You began your piece by talking to a man named Dustin McAdams. Why did you start with him?
Well, I started because it seemed sort of representative of things. I mean, he is younger than probably most of the people I spoke with, but I thought it was interesting because he said it was all about relatability and it was all about the candidate and not necessarily the party and how, whether the candidate relates to the issues or candidate relates to just being an authentic human being. And that's one thing we heard over and over again. And we do hear it a lot. So again, we'll see in November, you know, voters do tend to say, hey, I vote for, you know, a candidate, not necessarily for the party. So sometimes people don't always vote that way. But I do think in a region like Clay County, there might be something a little more to that, because it isn't sort of an area where it's like one party all the time, you know. And so it's like, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. You're probably voting for the party. You know, in a swing county, the candidates and their appeals and their campaigns are far more important.
You also came across a woman named Diane Cruz of Gladstone, who ultimately, Samuel, may be the perfect swing voter.
Yeah, she expressed to me that she voted for Republicans in the past. She pointed out she voted against Bill Clinton back when he was running in the 90s. But now she has been voting a Democratic. And one of the reasons she cited was the current administration with President Trump. She didn't sort of like the direction the administration was taken. And she seemed to be very lead into what Congress is doing as well. So she kind of sort of told how she's going to lean in the Senate race. But she is someone who says she has changed her opinions over the years. She said she would still be open to voting for Republicans. But at the moment, she has switched parties, basically, in terms of her voting patterns.
You know, I know you can only talk to so many people when you visit an area like Clay County, but did you sense any trends by either what you heard yourself or what people told you as you made your way around?
I think the biggest trend is people, and we know there's sort of the local political situation that's going there, which is a completely other topic. So, but with that and the national thing, I think people, you know, from whatever spectrum they had, the trend seemed to me is like they think that character and a willingness to work with members of the other party and being civil, all of those seem to be important. That is one thing that, you know, I didn't, you know, with a question, I didn't prompt that, but almost every person I talked to mentioned that. So that was the big trend. So it'll be for the candidates, it'll be interesting to see how they respond to that, how they sort of tailor their campaigns, if they're seeing the same thing on the ground as well, to that. So that's sort of that's one of the big things. And I think people were also concerned sort of still about the direction of the country, even though the economy is doing better. Mm-hmm. There is still people concerned about jobs and good jobs and well-paying jobs. So I think that's another thing that, particularly since they are the party in power, Republicans are going to have to watch out for, because just because the economy has improved, it doesn't mean everyone is feeling it. And that might be also reflected on Election Day.
Just a final point. If there's going to be a blue wave out across the country, you might begin to sense it in a place like Clay County. Did you?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I do think it is striking. And there's actually one more election here, too, and that we didn't mention is the right to work. Prop A overwhelmingly went down to defeating Clay County as well. So between the Lauren Arthur race and then the Prop A, that sort of seems that there's a lean there. But Republicans, again, have run strong there recently again. And so we'll just have to see.
That's KCUR Samuel King talking about what's going on up in Clay County when it comes to politics up there. Samuel, always good to have you. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about the history of Mexican-American baseball right here in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, from Lizzie Borden to Gilda Radner, we heard all about the independent movies and theaters these days. Hear our film critics' picks and other episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, Kansas City is home to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Now a group of authors is recalling the importance of baseball to Mexican Americans. Turns out baseball was very, very important as it helped the players confront discrimination and promote the spirit of social equality. Gene Chavez is among the authors of Mexican American Baseball in Kansas City, and he'll speak at the library on Wednesday evening. More on that in just a few moments. Gene Chavez is curator of the Kansas City Museum and a professor of counseling at Webster University, Kansas City. Gene, it's so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Steve.
Why a book on baseball and Mexican Americans?
Well, you know, it's one of those untold stories. And unless someone sits down and collects the information and the photos, as we did in this case, the story just doesn't get told. And most people don't really realize that there were Mexican-Americans going way back to the early 1900s playing right here in Kansas City and the region in amateur leagues as well as semi-pro leagues and later competing with other Mexican communities across the nation.
And baseball to them was important, as I mentioned. This was more important than just balls and strikes and the final score. It carried over into other aspects of their lives. How?
Well, you know, when you think about the era in which it grew and developed among Mexican immigrants, and we're going to focus on Mexican immigrants, though there are many other Latino groups who played baseball, and baseball was very important to them. But Mexican immigrants came to work in the United States, especially during the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s. And over a million people came from Mexico to take up jobs that were needed. They were braceros, and people who actually needed to work, and the United States needed them, given World War I and other things that were happening in the United States.
And that argument continues over to today, I should point out.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they came and they settled in communities, but they brought the love of baseball with them because Mexico had been playing baseball and often hosted many international games. And the Negro Leagues actually set many players, or many players opted to go to Mexico during the winter. And so they were, Mexican people had the opportunity to see the Negro League players. And interestingly, I just had a thing with Bob Kendrick over at the Negro League's Baseball Museum. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, you know, Mexico welcomed black players, and they were treated first class, best hotels, best restaurants. And it was such an ironic thing for Mexicans to come here and face discrimination and say, hey, well, you can't really play in this field. It's for white onlys, or you can't play in this particular team or league because it's for white only.
How did baseball help them deal with that kind of overt discrimination?
I think it brought a sense of solidarity and a camaraderie, as well as a sense of ethnic identity and pride to say, wait a minute, we've been playing this game in Mexico. We come here, we want to form our own teams,
yeah,
and we'd like to play with other teams. And so they made it, they made sure, and they were excellent athletes. There were many scouts who actually endeavored in the 40s to recruit and did recruit Mexican players right from the fields of Kansas, and we can mm-hmm. talk about that a little bit later. But that sense of solidarity and ethnic pride, I think, was the motivating factor. And they drew big crowds. It's very much like the Negro Leagues, who drew, they did barnstorming. They played in different places, and they would always draw huge crowds to come out and watch them play.
You know, you mentioned Kansas, and you point out in this book, Gene, that Kansas was once referred to as the Mississippi for Mexicans. I'd never heard that expression before. Tell us about it. And it was that bad?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, when you took a look at communities like Argentine, District of Kansas City, Kansas, mm-hmm. Armordale, and the west side, where many Mexican families settled during that period of large migration from 1910 to 1921 because of the Mexican Revolution that was taking place in Mexico, they faced blatant discrimination and relegated to certain neighborhoods. For example, in Argentine, they were allowed to live along the railroad tracks. There was a plot of land over 26th Street Bridge where the river was likely to flood and did flood and wiped out that whole community. And to this day, that particular community hasn't really been rebuilt. So they were segregated. Many of them, because they were Catholic, went to Catholic church. However, the white parishioners said, hey, they ought to have their own church. We don't want them associating with our kids. So we'd like to have them. And they pushed the diocese to start Mexican congregations. And so that happened. And then there were restaurants and theaters. You know, you could not go and sit down in a restaurant in Argentine or Armordale, but you could go to a side window, pick up, make an order and pick up your order there. So, you know, blatant discrimination was rampant in many communities. The West Side seemed a little bit more open to the Mexican immigrants.
The West Side of Kansas City, you're talking
West
about.
West Side of Kansas City, Missouri, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so these teams developed, and they were playing across state lines because the, most of them were related anyway. They were families or fellow church members, and so they often organized around industrial leagues, but they were all Mexican players because, again, they kept them segregated.
You know, tell us about how organized these leagues were. I mean, give us a sense of what the structure was.
Well, the structure was is that most cities had a league in which various teams played. Right here in Kansas City, one of the earliest teams that played in a Mexican American league was the Aztecas. The Aztecas was a team made up of Mexican immigrants. They played against then the Kansas City Angels, the State Line Locos. So they had names for them for their teams, and they would have regular tournaments. And so once the teams began to emerge, they then followed the rules of the leagues, and they themselves set those rules. But they followed, you know, amateur baseball rules. Later, after World War II, they actually developed fast pitch softball leagues because that was really sweeping the nation, fast pitch for, among men. Many of the vets who returned from World War II started playing fast pitch because baseball was a little bit more rigorous, the bases a little longer, mm-hmm. the pitcher mound a little bit further from the bay, from the home plate. So that was a thing that developed and continues to this day. There are even Mexican teams that continue to play throughout the country in the softball leagues, and they play by ASA rules, American Softball Association.
You know, I gather that these games were played on weekends primarily and after long days of work. Does that go without saying?
It does, yeah, because, you know, they worked hard, but they also played hard, and usually in the summertime, they would, after work, go directly to the ball field to practice. Mm-hmm. And then on the weekends, they would have games where they drew hundreds of people to come and watch the game. Of course, it was an era when there was no air conditioning, so it was nice to get outside in the summertime. Yeah. And there were no TV and other kinds of interruptions.
No iPhones and everything else, and internet and everything else.
Yeah.
And the work these players typically did during the day would be... What are we talking about here?
We're talking about the railroads. Kansas City was a huge draw for the Santa Fe Railroad, the Burlington Northern Railroad, the Union Pacific Railroad, and the industries that go along with the railroads, not mm-hmm. only the transportation aspect, but, for example, the ice houses. Many of the Mexicans, that was where they got their first job, even as teenagers, working the ice houses, packing the rail cars as they went by the packing houses and picked up the meat, put them into refrigeration. It was before refrigeration, and so they put them into the cars. They also worked in the packing houses and then the hospitality industries and other mostly labor-intensive jobs that they took.
I want to underscore a point you made a little bit ago. The level of play here was pretty darn good. In fact, you point out, and there's photographs in the book of any number of these players who wound up in the major leagues.
Yes. And in fact, one of the important players to Kansas City, and he's actually the first Mexican player to ever play in a major league team, professional team, was a guy by the name of Melo Almada, who played in 1933 for the Kansas City Blues. Mm. And it's interesting, going back to the question of discrimination, if they knew he were Mexican, they wouldn't have let anybody know. So they called him Spanish instead of Mexican.
Because, explain, I mean, that was, there's a big distinction there.
Yeah, the distinction there is that, hey, we'll let somebody from Europe, a Spaniard, play in the American leagues. And, you know, because of his light complexion face.
But a Mexican was seen as something worse.
Yeah, something that really isn't worthy of the game. And so that the stereotype that all Mexicans are, you know, dark complexion, black hair, dark eyes, short in stature, and so forth, you know, was a misconception, a stereotype that really didn't hold for most Mexicans. And in fact, when Mike Torres from Topeka, who grew up in these Mexican leagues, his father, his older siblings all played, and he became such a good pitcher in Topeka little leagues as well as the amateur leagues that he played in, the Mexican leagues, that the Cardinals, St. Louis Cardinals, recruited him right out of high school. And he went to play for the St. Louis Cardinals at the age of 19.
Gene Chavez is my guest. He's one of the authors of Mexican American Baseball in Kansas City. You can see and hear Gene at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Central Library at 14 West 10th Street downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, this is not just a story about men. In fact, the photo on the front cover of the book is of women. How important was baseball and softball to them?
Very important. Yeah, there were many women's teams, and they especially proliferated during World War II because a lot of the men, Mexican men especially, disproportionately were drafted into the armed services and mostly the Army, unless they thought ahead and joined the Navy or the Air Force or some other unit of the armed services. But even Mexican immigrants who were not fully documented were had an opportunity to join the war. So many of them, in fact, joined World War II and were off fighting the war. So then's when women took jobs, of course, that many men were doing, and they were part of the military-industrial complex, but also found joy in continuing the games that their husbands and boyfriends and so forth had played.
Why did the when did the heavy migration of Mexican Americans take place, Gene? And why did it, at least as far as our region is concerned?
Well, for our region, the first migration of Mexican people came during the time of the Santa Fe Trail, and especially towards the end of the era of the Santa Fe Trail, which lasted for about 80 years. And you know, when Bucknell and other traders went west on the what later became the Santa Fe Trail, they had no idea that actually Mexican merchants would become the biggest teamsters and truckers, as they called themselves, on the Santa Fe Trail, because they had much of what the U.S. needed. They had hard currency in Mexico, and they brought that and infused hard currency into the American economy. And Missouri was a beneficiary of that. You know, previous to building up high reserves of hard currency, everything was done on banknotes. And so Mexicans brought gold and silver in large quantities to the United States. And so many of the people came on the Santa Fe Trail coming east as merchants, bringing their kids to schools in St. Joseph, St. Louis, especially those two cities, the Catholic schools, the Jesuit schools that were there. Many Mexicans brought their kids here. And so that was the first migration. The second migration was the large number during the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1921.
You know, your book suggests that important institutions are now beginning to recognize the contributions of Mexican Americans to the game. I gather you feel that that's been way too long in coming.
Yes, I think that when you go to places, most museums, you'll find that there are representations of most groups. But in major institutions, what we found, what I have found, at least in my looking at collections and so forth, especially in the Midwest, is that the Mexican population is really underrepresented. And that's one of the reasons why I began working with the Kansas City Museum to make sure that Mexican-American, as well as other ethnic populations who are underrepresented, that those stories are told. And I've had an opportunity to curate a number of exhibits dealing with Mexican-American life.
Even the Smithsonian has taken note, Gene.
That's true. You know, when I first got involved with the Mexican-American Baseball Project, people ask me a lot of times, well, did you play baseball? Why are you so interested in it? Well, I'm interested in history. That's the main thing. And I'm interested in ethnic populations that are underrepresented.
Did you play baseball, Gene?
I actually played sandlot, and then in high school played a little. But my eyesight was not good, and I had problems with depth perception, so I really didn't. So it wasn't the love of baseball. It's the love of history and telling untold stories that got me involved. And I wrote a grant. The Smithsonian did a request for proposals on telling hometown team stories. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I got the idea of, well, let's tell the Mexican-American baseball story. And so I made a documentary film and then got the attention of the Smithsonian. They invited me out to D.C. To serve on a panel with the National Museum of American History. And they're putting together, along with the Smithsonian Latino Center, the history of Latino baseball in the United States. So I now serve on that committee to help them collect artifacts and to put together a traveling exhibit.
Gene Chavez, again, one of the authors of Mexican-American Baseball in Kansas City. You can see and hear him 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. Gene, thanks for coming in. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, a new app that teaches Kansas Cityans about our local history of segregation. Yes, there's an app even for that. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. And my producer said I'd have to report that this next part is happy birthday to me. There you go. I'm Steve Kraske. Happy birthday to me, and you are up to date.